He's a beautiful example of this, almost as good as Carly. In fact, in some ways, a better example. This is a true story from one of his campaign managers. He was in, when he was running for president in 2004, he was in Pittsburgh, a working class town, and he was asked what his favorite sport was. He said, sailing. And then he was asked, who was his favorite athlete? This is by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette Sports Reporter. Well, that year, Lance Armstrong was an American hero, won the Tour de France, et cetera, et cetera. Who does John Kerry mention? The guy who, the German who came in second in the Tour de France. What is, so.
Well, I guess Jim Collins, I think I heard this from Jim Collins, who wrote Good to Great, the short phrase to summarize what you've been saying is, rather than try to be interesting, be interested. That phrase is always stuck.
Well, that means listening, doesn't it? Listening. Let me just comment. Well, then let's open it up to the audience,
yeah.
Okay? I just want to make a little riff on listening. I honestly believe that it's one of the most powerful aspects of leadership, listening, not just hearing. In the Middle East, they have a great expression for leaders who stop listening, I mean, hearing. They say he's got tired ears. And there's something so disrespectful about not being listened to, not being, the word respect comes to my mind a lot. It's a big aspect of leadership, I think, is respect, is really, really, really hearing and listening others, in your case, the customer, but also your employee, you know. Okay, let's open it up. David, shall we?
You know, it's interesting you're talking about happiness and your idea that happiness is moments versus sort of that sustained, serene, sublime sense of satisfaction and happiness. And we live in a very complicated world where there's no lack of bad news and grim prognostications. I was seeing a quote the other day from Ronald Reagan, and he said, optimistic thinking is a choice and, frankly, a good choice. And then there was a gentleman, I don't know, it was Martin Seligman that wrote the book Learned Optimism, if you've ever read that book.
What's the book called?
Learned Optimism.
And Seligman.
Seligman, right. I think it was Martin Seligman. He did this great study on the MetLife salesman and who was more successful. And it turned out they profiled, they were the optimist and the pessimist. And the optimist sold 27% more than the pessimist did.
They also live longer, by the way.
And live longer. But the other thing that what he reluctantly acknowledged toward the end of the book was, it says that, and I'm sort of quoting this out of context, it says, optimists tend to be slightly out of touch with what's going on, but they're happier. And pessimists tend to see better what's going, they're slightly sadder, but they're in better context with what's really going on around them. And so I guess my question to you is that if we are listening and watching, you can't help but see all the negative potentials, whether it's in your business, the world around you, the economy, certainly the healthcare debate has accelerated that in the most gruesome way. How do you achieve happiness while still staying in real touch with what's going on around you?
Well, I guess I would have two answers to that. I remember when I was in Kentucky where our warehouse is, was watching in the hotel lobby, there was this comedian on TV and said, basically, you have a choice when you're married. You can either be happy or you can be right. And you can't. And so, and he's, you know, with his relationship was choosing to be happy. I think a lot of it, it's not so much about being out of touch as it is about just deciding what to focus on. Well, we were talking about earlier in terms of the optimism that entrepreneurs have, but the entrepreneurs that are able to create businesses are still in touch with all the realities, but they are optimistic about what can be accomplished. But then, and I guess I would separate that from people that are just not in touch at all with reality and are always optimistic, even if the reality of the situation is says they shouldn't be. So I think it's a subtle difference, but maybe rather than use the word optimism, which, you know, different people have different interpretations of, I would use entrepreneurial-like optimism.
I think it's a marvelous question, just a quick response. I think true, you can see both sides of it, as just Tony was saying, but it'd be nice to have a couple of people around you if you're a person like me. I think it's no accident that my wife I call Dr. No, because I tend to be impulsive about certain things, and she's always there. You know, in my memoir, I have a line that says, any man over 60 should marry a doctor. I did. And so she's always ready to say, why are you doing this? And why? I mean, sometimes it gets to be a pain in the neck, but I always find it useful. So putting it into an executive suite, to have some people around you who tend to look at the dark side more than you do, is quite helpful.
This question is for Tony. By the way, Tony, my name is James Shea, and I have to thank you for bringing the Shea's name to a worldwide brand household name.
Okay. Oh, by the way, just a comment. So last name is spelled H-S-I-E-H.
Yes.
And
you're not Irish. I thought.
And so I'm sure you've come across the same issue, but anytime I try to spell it out to people, I'd say 80% of the time, if I just say H-S-I-H, they write S-H. And so...
Brother, I feel your pain.
Okay.
Yes.
But so I'm going to...
And whoever invented our last name spelling, I must contest.
But I'm going to give you some tips, actually, that I've learned over the years. So what I found is, for whatever reason, if you just say H-S-I-E-H, people almost always write down S-H. But if you say H as in Harry, S as in Sam, I-E-H... they always get it right.
That's exactly how I do it, too.
Oh, really? And
oh,
you use Harry and Sam? That's weird.
Yeah.
Anyways.
So,
So I always thought, like, you know, the last name was one of those things that just didn't make sense because it's pronounced Shea, but it's I before E. It's just really confusing. But I did discover if you actually translate it into Morse code, it's 4 dots, 3 dots, 2 dots, 1 dot, 4 dots. So there's a
lot.
Wow,
I learned something today. So, well, first of all, thank you for making us famous. But at the same token, thank you for putting a lot of pressure on me. You know, one day my father opened up the newspaper and showed me the newspaper and saying, hey son, this kid, Tony Shea, is only 33, you're almost 40, and how come your income's much less than his? And we're both in the internet field. I own an internet marketing consulting company. And so I have this question for you.
Did you ask permission to ask a second question?
Oh, may I ask you the most important question, I guess, is that I know you emphasize a lot on culture, your company culture. And I can't help but stop thinking this is what made Zappos very profitable today. Did you have the foresight that shaping this culture was going to make your company profitable, or was it just happened naturally for you?
Originally, it was just for selfish reasons. I was more just thinking about what would I personally enjoy. And, you know, for the first 4 or 5 years, culture, it was more about I didn't want to make the same mistake I made at Link Exchange. So we always said, okay, culture is important. But it wasn't actually until 5 years or so into it that we decided to actually make culture the number one priority for the company. And so it was only at that time that we explicitly, you know, went through this year-long process of asking our employees what should our core values be and then put into place all the processes and procedures, you know, like the two sets of hiring interviews that we do. And then part of me, and it was probably right about that time where I read Good to Great by Jim Collins. And so I don't think we're really pioneering anything new. Like, we're just, I guess, learning on our own what's already been researched out there. In Good to Great, Jim Collins talks about, they look at what separates the great companies from just the good ones in terms of long-term financial performance. And two of the things that they found the great companies had that the good ones didn't were, one was a really strong culture or core values. One of the things they found was that it actually doesn't matter what your core values are. It just matters that you have them and you commit to them because that creates alignment in the entire organization. Everyone speaks a common language and it's just a default way of thinking. And then the second thing was having a vision or higher purpose beyond just money or profits or being number one in the market. And so those were things that, you know, we kind of accidentally stumbled into and, you know, slowly over time adopted for ourselves. And it just, I think we just got lucky in that it actually turns out to be the stuff that Jim Collins says we should do. And same with tribal leadership. They found similar things.
David, is there a chance, would you mind if the, your 10 values, Zeppel's core values, were distributed to the Omni?
Yeah, it's actually, they're actually in the book, too.
So oh, it's in the book. Okay, the book. It's in the book. Okay, good, because they're very, I think they're so, and if there were time to get into how we created this in the organization is really interesting.
So in just a few moments we have left, let's turn to what we call burning questions, which means if you don't ask the question that you have in mind, there's a chance you may spontaneously combust later in the day. So we have a burning question back here.
Thanks for coming out here. You had mentioned in that the culture, when you first started, kind of got away from you, and we've read countless case studies of cultures that have started strong and then sort of meandered off to the side, which would make the assumption that a culture can change even without the consent of the very top. So for those of us who are in the middle of an organization, how can we impact and sort of course correct the culture to make it for the better? Because obviously it happens, but what active steps can we do to sort of change the direction the way we might think things should be?
So for us at Zappos, most organizations, as they grow larger, the culture goes downhill, and it can't be up to just the top, however many, you know, executives or whatever. It, you know, not only do we not want the culture to go downhill, but we actually want it to get stronger and stronger as more employees come. Like, we want the culture to scale. And so the only way that can happen is if every employee views as part of his or her job responsibility to live and inspire the culture in others and help build those cultures. And so we're always trying to think of, okay, what's next? And actually, one of the pretty exciting projects that we're working on internally is actually a result of Dave Logan's work and he talks about, how many of you have read Tribal Leadership? He talks about creating triads and basically three-person relationships instead of two-person relationships. And, you know, there's a few interesting things about that. If you actually graph out the relationships in an organization, and he actually just visited Zappos a few weeks ago and showed us a sample company they had worked with, it actually doesn't take that many, if you're strategic about it, it actually doesn't take that many triadic relationships to actually shift a culture from level three to level four, or just get everyone more connected. And so one of the things that we're in the process of building at Zappos is actually using our own internal tools. We have this thing called the face game, where as part of the process of logging into our systems, it actually just shows you a random employee's face, and then it used to be it's multiple choice, you have to guess who it is, and then once you guess it, then it shows you that employee's bio, and, you know, kind of like the equivalent of a Facebook profile page, but it's on our internal system. So we actually just launched and modified the system so that if they guess correctly, it'll ask them, how well do you know this person, on a scale 1 to 5, and 5 being we're going to be lifelong friends, and 1 or 2 is I'll say hi to them if I happen to pass in the hallway. And so from that, our system is basically, we want to create our own internal social graph that looks at not only how many triads we have, but the strengths, the different types of triads and strengths of triads, and then we want employees to be more conscious about just the concept of triads. And one of the interesting things I learned from the book and from Dave Logan about triads is that if there's three people, so let's say yourself, myself, and one other person, the third person is the one that's responsible for the strength of the other two people's relationship. Mm-hmm. And so if you and I get into an argument about shoes or something, then this person acts as kind of moderator. But if each person in the triad actually feels and knows it's their responsibility to strengthen the other two's relationship, it creates a pretty interesting dynamic. So that's where we're headed, and I think that's something where you don't need to be at the top of an organization to start forming more triads in your company.
We have time for just one more burning question. Okay, saw your hand first.
It's kind of along the line was what he was saying about for culture. Now that you sold a company to Amazon, how do you think the two will mesh together? Because obviously they're very different. And are there steps or agreement between Sapo and Amazon to mesh well together? Or?
So specifically, one of the prerequisites for us to even consider the whole Amazon acquisition was that they leave us independent. And so from our perspective, it's basically been the equivalent of swapping out our board of directors with a new one. Our previous board came more from a technology background, didn't really have much retail experience. And so, if anything, you know, having a new board, quote-unquote, you know, it's not officially a board. We call it a management committee. But it's basically three people from Zappos and three people from Amazon. So the equivalent of a board of directors, we meet quarterly. But having a board that gets retail much more, and, you know, they have the whole history and really value, thinks in the long term in terms of customer experience and what's right for the customer, that's been great. But they've also allowed us to do our thing, things the Zappos way, to continue to build our culture, our brand, run business our way. And so we've actually come across instances where something is not right for Amazon to do. Like, they make a decision about something, they say, no, we're not going to do this, or we're taking this stance on this, and we've taken the opposite stance in terms of, for example, what vendors to work with, or even what who to partner with, for example. We've actually had a few instances where we've tested our independence, and they've remained true to their word.
Let's give them both a round of applause.
This has been an Ashet audio production of Delivering Happiness, A Path to Profits, Passion, and Purpose. Written and read by Tony Shea. Produced by John Clem. Directed by Bob Walter. Recorded by Matthew Wong. Post-production by Philip Levy and John Clem. Delivering Happiness is also available in print from Business Plus, a division of Ashet Book Group. Text copyright 2010 by Tony Shea. Audio production copyright and published 2010 by Ashet Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.